We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 202. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is your expert, your legal genius mind, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm good. I am not, however, a scientific expert, so we reached into our bag of tricks to produce this week's guest. I'm very, very excited about.
Yeah, Cybabe returning to the show. And this is a great topic to talk about, too, because this Roundup trial thing sounds like a good intersection of a bunch of topics that we would love to talk about. So I'm excited for that. And well, I don't have anything else before we get going. How about you?
No, let's get into it.
It's Phoebe's second birthday. Can you believe that it already? Oh, no, that's never mind. I guess I don't have any.
I am also, right, so, you know, the intro is just starting to sound right now, right? It's
yeah,
I'm
yeah,
getting used to the change. I love it. Maybe our best one yet. So
Brian just has that canned response from Andrew. Just maybe our best one yet. That should be just play it before.
Yeah, I'm not actually here. Thomas is just recording this, you know. It's all.
All right.
Well, Thomas, how are you today?
Doing it in the butt is awesome. Yeah, and then that, yeah. all right.
That required
let's get
less
to the
editing
show.
than it should have.
So this Roundup trial, you're going to kind of set the table for us a little bit, to use that corporate-y lingo that the guy in 12 Angry Men is joking about, for this segment with Cybabe. What do you got for us?
Yeah. So this is a complaint. It's a single individual plaintiff. His name is Dwayne Johnson, apparently not The Rock, who, by the way, this came across my Alexa the other day. Like, did you know Dwayne The Rock Johnson is the highest paid actor of all time, according to Forbes magazine?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, all time?
Of
I didn't
all
know all time.
Time.
I knew he keeps being the answer to, like, who's the highest paid actor this year? And then you're like, you don't even think of him. And you go for, like, Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise is not keeping up with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Yeah. But now he's got to add this Roundup money. So now he's even further ahead.
Yeah, this is actually Dwayne The Rock Johnson earned $124 million in 2017. The jury awarded Dwayne, not The Rock
the not
Johnson,
Rock to... Yeah, you have to basically add that to your Dwayne,
yeah,
not
you,
The Rock
clearly,
Johnson.
Right, this is the office space, right? Like, you know, Michael Bolton. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
I was,
so what's
I
your
favorite?
Yeah, people
first.
Ask him, what's your favorite Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie? And he's like, yeah, I don't really like him.
He was awarded $289 million.
Wow.
So let's break that down, right? We're going to have Cybabe on to talk about the science. Here are the facts. So in 2014, Mr. Johnson was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at the age of 42. Virtually all non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are idiopathic, which is to say we don't know what caused them, right? It's just we don't know. His lawsuit alleges that his cancer was caused by glyphosate, And in fact, paragraph 84, we're going to upload the complaint. We are going to upload, I think our listeners will enjoy this. We're going to upload the jury verdict form, right? Because it's not something that we've talked about or
oh, I thought you were going to say, and we're going to upload the new Jumanji with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Oh, yeah. I thought we were just,
No, so and I'm going to talk. I'm going to go through what the jury held. But paragraph 84, right, specifically alleges that the glyphosate quote posed a grave risk of cancer, and then the complaint. I've taught you all how to read complaints. There are seven causes of action, but basically they boil down to three claims. Right, first is strict liability. We talked about this on Friday's episode 201 that glyphosate is inherently dangerous and unsafe. Right. Second, strict liability, a different theory. That is the theory of failure to warn. Right. And the key question there is, were the risks of glyphosate knowable at the time the product was used? And if so, then should Monsanto be held strictly liable for their failure to say, hey, look, this is a carcinogen? And then the third cause of action for negligence. And again, we talked about the distinction between those two in episode 201. That is, what would a similar seller slash manufacturer of glyphosate have done in light of the known risks? And the allegation is that Monsanto failed to abide by that standard of care. So that gets us to what the jury actually held. And this is interesting. So there are five line items on the jury's verdict. The first is for past economic damages. That's $800,000. And economic damages, I should point out, in a trial context are defined really, really narrowly. Right? That means your medical bills. Right? Second line item, future economic damages, $1.4 million. Right? So $2.2 million in current, past, anticipated future medical expenses. The next two line items are for non-economic damages, and like I said, that's kind of a weird it's kind of a weird way of describing it because you're getting money, right? Like, so it's not.
Yeah.
But this is everything that is harder to quantify, right? Pain and suffering type damages, diminished capacity, right? Like the other aspects of rendering you whole, because you know if you right. Super easy way of explaining that is, right, I drive over your leg and your leg has to be amputated. The economic damages are paying your hospital bills.
I thought you have to give me your leg, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Well, and then I have to be your butler. So just paying your hospital bills, right? You know, if we were confined to economic damages, you would be like, that has not rendered me whole because before Andrew, terrible driver, came along, I had two legs and now I don't. Right. So non-economic damages are past non-economic, $4 million, future non-economic, $33 million. But you might notice that we're still only at $39.2 million total. And that gets us to the final line, punitive damages, $250 million. And the wow. Punitive damages are based on the allegation that that Monsanto knew or should have known that its product was inherently dangerous, and they used it anyway. And the standard in California law is that they acted with malice or oppression. Right. That is, they were so that they had such disregard for the consequences of their action that it amounted to malice, that it amounted to an animus against individual consumers. We're going to break down the science on all of that. But let me give you a little bit of a preview before we bring Cybabe on. I think on appeal, this verdict has been appealed. The appellate courts may tweak the damage numbers somewhat, but ultimately, I think all of the line items are going to stand. I think that that the courts are going to say that it was reasonable for the jury to award punitive damages in this case. That's going to meet the legal standard. I think they're going to say it was reasonable to award non-economic and economic damages in this case. Oftentimes, appellate courts will scale that down and will say there isn't a rational relationship between the number the jury picked and the particular finding. And that wouldn't surprise me. But the threshold question is basically, could the jury rationally determine from the evidence presented before it that Roundup, that Monsanto's product containing glyphosate, caused the injuries suffered by plaintiff and award the damages that they did? And I think from a legal perspective, I think that answer is going to be yes. Now, we're going to figure out how well that maps to reality in the next segment. But there you go.
Holy moly. I wasn't expecting that. Okay. Well, are we doing an anti-vax segment too? Like how it's reasonable that... Jeez. Okay. All right. Well, I guess we need Cybabe to help us sort through this.
Yep.
Yvette, Cybabe, welcome back to the show.
Thomas, it's wonderful to be back here. And Andrew, of course, it's wonderful to be back here too.
Oh, is Andrew here? Oh, is he still here?
Where are
you?
Yeah,
I'm just hanging out over here. That's all good. Right? This show can only have one, one person who's an expert at the time. So I'm passing the torch over. Well, two. I mean, obviously, Thomas, expert interviewer, but one subject at a time.
We know a few experts on this, but I'm here and I'm adorable, and why not?
Okay. Yeah. And you also have like an arch nemesis, right? It's like the in all those movies that I don't watch, you get Ant-Man's got like Scorpion Man or something. There's always a themed rival, and you've got Food Babe, right? Food Babe's been at it again with this.
It was funny. Someone tweeted the other day, has anyone seen Food Babe for a while? And there were so many responses going, maybe it's because Gwyneth Paltrow's taken over the market. Hey, someone said, she's had a baby and changed her marketing techniques, and that's all true. And I just responded, haven't the foggiest, with a gif of Luke Skywalker, brushing the dirt off his shoulder. And I'm like, she really, if you, and somebody else posted a graph of the Google searches for her. And the day that my article came out on her, after that, the instances of her website being searched, the traffic to it, all dropped off dramatically after that article. It was insane. I didn't realize it had happened that dramatically until someone posted that the other day.
Well, she's at it again because she has posted an article about how this glyphosate. Yeah. That how it's in all our cereals and we're all going to die. So she's back at it. It's going to be a sequel to your superhero movie, I guess, where you got to take her out. So
I don't like taking people out like in the death sense, but I do think that there needs
in
to
the science
there,
sense.
There might need to be another piece of writing eventually. It's just here's. I think I like to concentrate on people that are getting a lot of traction in the mainstream. That was why Food Babe was getting a lot of attention and skepticism, which I think was appropriate because, she was everywhere. She was on CNN. She had two pieces written in the New York Times. Can you imagine?
Wow.
That blows my mind.
I thought you had
mind.
To be a Nazi to get pieces written on me. Oh.
We've come so far in such a short period of time. We went from bullshit food writers to Nazis. I mean, it's a lateral move, really.
Why do these Nazis do what they do? We just need 10,000 more think pieces on them. But anyway,
let's talk about
Roundup and let's talk about glyphosate.
Do you have any idea how many times I've seen it spelled glyphosate in the last few days? Well, from people correcting me that it's not a pesticide, it's an herbicide. Now, first, I just want to throw this out here. Yes, it's an herbicide. For all the listeners out there that are pedants or that just like to correct people on things, as some of us in here do, yes, indeed, it is an herbicide. However, pesticide does not refer to things that kill just insects. Pesticide is the blanket term for everything that kills anything in a field that's a pest towards your crops, and that includes weeds, fungus. It's nematodes, like any rodents. Like, yeah, oh yeah, we have rodenticides, piscicides, things that you throw into the water to kill fish. Even oh yeah, there are anything that is used to kill a pest towards your thing that you're trying to grow. It's a pesticide. So. That's my, I use pesticide interchangeably with all of those terms. So gotcha. That's just to throw it out there before you guys get a bunch of angry emails or I get the angry emails, be it the case.
We treasure and love every one of our pedantic corrected emails that we get, but yes, indeed, we do get emails. So yeah, you want to talk about something that is, I think, dominating the news right now is the result of the Roundup trial, state court in California. A jury has awarded $289 million to an individual plaintiff, not a class action.
Yeah, of which that's
the
crazy.
Overwhelming majority of that, right? $250 million, quarter of $1 billion in punitive damages. And the central allegation, and this is what I'm trying to find out, is that the chemical in the herbicide Roundup, glyphosate, quote, posed a grave risk of cancer, end quote. That's the key factual finding. So, why don't we start with that, right? What is glyphosate? And, you know, let's kind of dig down into that.
Yeah, it's where to start. So, glyphosate works in a mechanism in plant that basically stops EPS. Synthase, and that stops a handful of other things from happening in the plant. Now, here's the thing. The mechanism it works on in plants, this doesn't occur in humans. So we don't even have the pathway in our body that glyphosate makes, that glyphosate works on. It is absurdly non-toxic to humans from all the testing that's happened on it. When I say all the testing, I mean in order to get a pesticide, any of these types of agricultural chemicals onto market, it goes through something like 800, it goes through hundreds of tests. And because it's been under so much suspicion.
Counterpoint, I drank some Roundup and now I can't do photosynthesis, so.
It's, you know, I'm not, could you do photosynthesis before? How well could you play the violin before this, Thomas? That's the thing is that people got scared of Roundup, and this is speculative, but I think the big scare with Roundup came because people went, yeah, they had to genetically modify the plants in order for us to put Roundup on it for them to live. So people just genetically modified it to sell more of their demon Roundup. And that's, you know, it's that thing where a little bit of truth sells a really big lie. And the really big lie is that this chemical was really toxic, and that was why they had to modify the plants. And it's not that it's toxic, it's that it targets this one tiny mechanism that a lot of plants have. And they just had to genetically modify it so that this mechanism wasn't affected. So here's the thing. That doesn't mean it's more toxic. It means it's very targeted. And toxicity is a very tricky thing to figure out if something is highly, horribly toxic or not. And the thing is, we generally tend to measure it in how much of it or how little of it will kill or harm you. And there is, you know, there is a huge amount of Roundup compared to other pesticides that we used to use before it that will hurt you. Like I think the other thing is, like, we just, all we ever see with Roundup, we'll see this graph of, yeah, since Roundup and GMOs have been introduced, Roundup went from, you know, very little use to a ton of use. I'm like, wow. So kind of like when we introduced iPhones, we went from very few iPhones being used to a ton of iPhones being used. Fancy
to
that.
To which the person will say, well, those cause cancer too.
Yeah. Organic foods just came out not that long ago. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to unpack, like, there are like three or four things that you said that I think are really, really interesting. And in fact, we actually got a listener question that he didn't know you were going to be on, but he was going through our back catalog and had asked about OA-120, in which we had our mutual friend Natalie Newell on. It was called OA Shills for Monsanto. And so he actually has a question about GMOs and glyphosate, which I want to pose to you. I want to pose to you a little later, but
I hope I know the answer.
Me too. But I want to go back to the first thing that you said, which had to do with the level of testing that was undertaken before Roundup could go to market, right? Can you like talk to me about that process, right? What, you know, what kind of tests, how many,
oh, yeah.
How, you know, how repeatable? Yeah.
Yeah. What I happens? Mean, now the type of lab I worked in, now I just want to clarify this. I have no ties to the company that I used to work for. And the company that I used to work for, I never worked on anything that Monsanto worked on. I know that I believe that they had some contracts with Monsanto. I was not involved in any of that. But we were under the same...
What was the prior company? Oh, I mean, just as long as we're doing disclosure. Yeah. Let's be formal.
And I mean, I think I've said this multiple times in the lab before or on the internet before. I worked at Ambat Chemical Company. And here's the thing, I loved working there. Great. I had the nicest boss that I had in my entire working history there. Like, why would I? It's when I was laid off because they were having bad times financially, they didn't just give me a 3-month severance. They covered my health insurance for 3 months after I left, which kind of allowed me to go out and try to start SciBabe. It's hard to speak ill of a company that treated me like family. And they were so good to me there. They gave me a chance to really grow as a scientist. Anyways, the kind of neat thing was I got this inside look into agriculture and to how the testing works and to how careful and heavily regulated the testing is. And every so often, and I say this as someone who will never not be a liberal, more than likely, I'd hear someone who was a cranky old Republican saying, there's too much regulation, it's slowing things down. I'm like, this is going on my food. Shut the fuck up. I'm going to take as much time as I need to getting this done. It's, you know, we would... The level of so there's something that we have in these types of lab called GLP testing. It's good laboratory practices. And that basically mm-hmm. means if you throw a glove off, you have to write it down. And that's a little bit of exaggeration, but not really. But anything you write down, any paper that's ever printed, and I'm not exaggerating on that, you have to submit that to the EPA with your report, if it's the type of report you submit to the EPA. But GLP studies, like, they never get thrown out. They have to be written in a way that everything you put, everything you write is kept with the company forever. So that you have a record of what you've done with this chemical. So, I mean, after you've done preliminary testings, and this is, you know, you figure out if you have a stable both compound and formulation, and, you know, then you start doing testing on it. And you'll go through, you know, 50 formulations to figure out which one's a stable one. And if they're not stable, if they don't work, you throw them out. Like, you find ones that don't work before you find ones that do. And it's part of the testing is they'll go through heat stability testing. They'll go through short-term testing of that. They'll go through long-term testing at higher temperatures. You'll put them through multiple types of machinery and different chemists will test this in different laboratories under different conditions to make sure that it's not just one chemist who has a vested interest in it. So they are tested under blind conditions.
Let me ask on that a little bit, because I could imagine a substance being very stable, but nevertheless very toxic, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
So what is the
stability?
I'm just trying to understand the stability.
Stability is not just it, but also, like, I was just one end of it. Like, I would test the final product because I was the analytical chemist. I was the one who could design the test to extract the chemical from whatever matrix it was in, tell you what percentage was in it, tell you if it broke down into a couple of other ions, any dangerous ions. And yes, we did test to make sure that it was free of or at a level of dioxin that was undetectable. And I mean, we were very careful, especially about the dioxins. And we had to make sure that if it was in a matrix that we couldn't extract it out of to make sure that we knew what the percentage was of the chemical, we couldn't sell it. How crazy is that? Like, the matrix had to be examinable. But as your question was for toxicity, that was actually a different department. And it could take 6 months to get something back from toxicity testing, even if it was just a re-registration sometimes. So we were, that was an entirely different department. And sometimes, I would go through the toxicity reports before I would start evaluating something in my lab. Because what did we find in toxicity and how does this affect how I have to handle this? Like, we had chemicals that were crazy higher toxic than Roundup. It's like Roundup, just to give you a quick idea of how toxic it is. I know I've said before it's less toxic than table salt, caffeine, aspirin, those things. the higher the LD50 on it, and LD50 for the readers at home, LD50 stands for lethal dose for 50% of the population. So give or take, if 50% of people, or it's, and generally this is extrapolated from rat studies. We don't throw 100 people into a room and say, now try this. This cookie.
Raise your hand if you're dead.
Oh, Thomas. We do extrapolate these, but you know, they're pretty well based on some firm data. But you know, with Roundup, the LD50 is, I believe, 5,000 milligrams per kilogram. It's really, really high. And I know those numbers mean very little to people in the real world, but just take that number and think about what I just said, 5,000 milligrams per kilogram. That's pretty close to what it is for things like I said, aspirin, coffee, vinegar. That's an absurdly, and when I say, you know, you want a higher number for LD50, because that means you need to take more of it to kill you. I've worked with pesticides that were about 5 milligrams per kilogram, that it basically said, don't inhale it at all or you're going to be on the floor. Organophosphates are absurdly toxic, and I wish we didn't even use them anymore. So it's,
I want to put a pin in that, and I want to get to that, but, sorry, I can't help but kind of do the lawyer's cross examination here.
Please do it.
LD50, right? And so the LD50 is a measure of short term toxicity. What about the allegations long-term in this complaint are long-term non-Hodgkin's lymphoma that it's carcinogenic, right? So it might not kill 50% of the rats immediately, but how do you test for that?
They also do long-term carcinogenicity and tetragonicity testing. Or I might have mispronounced it.
Oh, yeah, I hate
they do,
when I get tarragon from one of these things. What was that?
I might have mispronounced that. It's the one where they test in utero for fetal development. Is it tarragonicity or tetragonicity? I always mix that one up. It's every so often.
Tarantella tetanicity. It's one of something
it's,
like
it's
that.
It's Tarantinogenicity. That's what I'm going to call it now. It's the one where we figure out why Tarantino is so screwed up. Basically, it's if it affects fetal development. But no, there are, and these are things that, again, come from rat models in general. But again, these are a lot of different testings that are done, and we do carcinogenicity testings. And these are, it is extrapolated from animal models, but you know, it's testing done in animal models over a long period of time. So this, I believe, Roundup went through, I want to say it was 13 years of study before it made market, and that's pretty standard for these. These, you know, they go through, you know, we notice it can kill a plant. All right, which plants does it kill? And I mean, it couldn't get it onto market until there were crops it worked with. So this one was studied, and it was like, okay, are there crops this will work with? They had to wait until they developed and tested sufficiently for something like 15 or 20 years genetically modified crops. So they came out, you know, together after tons of testing. But I understand, back to your question about if there's a possibility that we missed something, that it was possibly long-term causing this, the odds, I would have to say, are astronomically low. It's especially because in the places where they're seeing these types of cancers that they're trying to link to it, there really hasn't been a jump in them compared to anywhere else where you don't see these types of foods. Like, these are not, there is no spike in these cancers above and beyond just what you'd expect from people living longer lives. Like as much as I would love for us to all live to be 250 years old, that doesn't seem to be happening. We are all deteriorating. It is a sad little fact of life. And eventually, if you don't die of things like polio, smallpox, you know, all those diseases that we got rid of, or, you know, just getting kicked in the face by a horse or dying in childbirth, all those other wonderful things that medicine took care of, cancer is going to bite you in the ass. That is a thing that happens in all populations that live a long time, is that they have higher rates of cancer. And because we've gotten really good at feeding the population, and that is something that came with the Green Revolution and with us, you know, it started with being able to fight off, you know, to to crossbreed crops to be more resistant to things like the rust fungus, which was responsible for a ton of famine in the developing world. That, you know, this started with hybridization and moved on to genetic modification and to the more new age pesticides and herbicides. It's been a slow climb to where we are now, but being able to feed people, there are two ways this could lead to more increases in cancer. One is that being overweight is correlated. They're not sure the exact mechanisms, but it is linked to higher rates of cancer. So it's not necessarily the insecticides or the pesticides or any of the chemicals that are sprayed on the food, but it can be the increase in weight. And that's not because of the chemicals in it, other than the calories. And that's really an unfortunate thing. It's not the pesticides, just that we're eating too much. The other thing is, because we're not dying from famine, we live long enough to get cancer. So that's
right. it becomes a higher percentage. But I am curious.
I know you're going to keep pressing me on this.
Yeah, and sorry.
That's fine. I know, that's fine. It's like I have yet to see. Like, here's the thing: is I've looked through every last thing I can get my hands on. I've yet to see any compelling study that pins down glyphosate or any of the other ingredients in it as possibly being a cause of cancer, either in people who work directly with it or in people who consume food with it on it. Now, one of the most damning pieces of information on this is that I'm sure you're familiar with the IARC, the International mm-hmm. Agency for Research on Cancer. They had released a thing saying that coffee was a possible carcinogen or a probable, like at one point they had said possible carcinogen and they were looking into bumping it up to probable carcinogen. So there's 2B and then 2A and then type 1 carcinogen or group 1 carcinogen. Those are your cigarettes. I believe the sun should be in there too, even if it's, I think it might not be, but it should be because obviously the sun, that's going to give you some cancers.
Monsanto gave us the sun, those bastards.
Yeah, we all know we didn't have the sun until Monsanto. And now the sun, look at the incidence of the sun happening way up since Monsanto.
Since the beginning of time, man has yearned to destroy the sun. I will do the next best thing. Block it out.
Figured out a way to do that, as I keep mentioning, in California. We just burn the whole thing to the ground, and then you never see the sun again. It's cool.
I still feel bad that we haven't hung out, Thomas. I need to make this happen. On the IARC, there is a... There is some amazing... Like, a huge report came out at Reuters, and if you'll allow me to just read this straight off, there is... If you'll allow me to just read this about the this amazing piece of investigative journalism from Reuters. I always pronounce this like alternatively three different ways, and I apologize. But here's a quick excerpt about the piece and a special report published in June of 2017. Investigators at Reuters uncovered the shocking fact that an American scientist, Dr. Aaron Blair, the chairman of the IARC, Monograph 112 on glyphosate, suppressed critically important science. And here's the thing: this isn't any tiny bit of science. It's not a minor report. This is a huge report that was suppressed in this. And there were also other bits of reports throughout this. Like, this is a small thing that I'm taking in an excerpt from, but it seemed like there were other bits of data through it that had negative findings that, like, they altered their conclusions to turn them into positive findings. In other words, saying yes, Roundup does cause cancer, and it was very strange. But the biggest thing that was suppressed, this hidden science in question in the recent data from the Agricultural Health Study, the largest and most comprehensive study ever conducted on pesticide exposure in humans, evidence showed that Dr. Blair withheld updated data from the study, which evaluates pesticide exposure on more than 50,000 farmers and their families. The updated data reinforces the study's original conclusions in 2005 that there is no evidence linking glyphosate exposure to cancer incidence. And this is really compelling data. Like, these are the people that are going to be exposed to it the most. No link. And that just bothers me an absurd amount. Like, I remember a few years ago, I have a friend, Dr. Shelley McGuire, who is a breast milk researcher. And there was, you know, a mommy blogger who tried to claim that breast milk was just loaded with Roundup from, you know, from women who were exposed to it. And so Shelley McGuire, being, you know, a research scientist in this area, was like, that just doesn't sound right. So she looked at the study, at the way that they conducted the study, found a couple of flaws in how they'd analyzed it, and couldn't, and they wouldn't release to her their research methods. And so she was like, all right, I'll conduct a better study. She'd conducted the study, had an independent lab try to verify her report. They even took samples from women who were working in fields on, you know, working in farming on days that they'd sprayed Roundup, and they could find nothing. So I think this is kind of your gold standard for it, is finding people who've worked at farms and finding nothing. And that's
okay. So two things that I want to drill down on here. And again, there's so much that, you know, I feel like we could do 6 hours on this. In 2015, the World Health Organization classified glyphosate as a probable carcinogen, right? So when you talked about the differing levels.
It's important to point out the IARC is a subgroup of the World Health Organization.
Right. Right.
So just wanted to clarify.
As part of that classification, so is your explanation then that classification was based in whole or in part on the Blair data that was suppressed? Or I just want to make sure that I understand the role of the competing Blair data.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. I believe that, I mean, this is speculative, of course. But I believe that if they had been more honest with their evaluation of the data, or if they had kept all of the data in there, if they hadn't admitted, if they, I think if they had, you know, presented their report and let, you know, any other scientist, anyone who wasn't trying to, if the report had not been, shall we say, so selective, the report shouldn't have concluded the way it had. It should have included this data. It was cherry picked, and I believe it was trying to doctor the data. Again, this is in my opinion, but I think that if the report had included this, and if it hadn't, as the Reuters report is telling me, you know, change things. And again, this report that they've done some bang up investigative journalism on, there's no one at the IARC who's been willing to talk to them. It's, you know, if someone with the IARC would be able to come out and show them, no, you have inaccurate information, here's what we had, I would be like, you know, I guess maybe I was wrong. But no one's been willing to you know, tell them that they have incorrect information. And that's telling quite a bit. That's horrifying to me, really. I wish, like, it bothers me that I can't tell people that I have confidence in this government agency. Is it an NGO or no? I mean, I guess it's not an NGO, but it bothers me that I can't tell people that they can have faith in this. But I think, again, if the Reuters report is accurate, then there is no way this would have happened.
Okay, time to do an ad. This week's episode is brought to you by Beachbody On Demand. Beachbody On Demand is an online portal. You get instant access to their streaming service that gives a wide variety of effective workouts that you can do from the comfort of your own home. Here's how it works. You log in. I do it on my phone. You can then select your difficulty level, the amount of time you have for the workout, what you want to do with that workout, right? Slimming, building your core, building muscle, whatever. And then it filters out and you can choose from among the programs. So I've been doing the 10-minute trainer with Tony Horton. I've been doing that because obviously I'm incredibly busy all the time. But you can make 10 minutes a day to work out. And I've been really happy with the program, really happy with the results. So if you've been thinking about losing weight, maybe try it out with me. And as of right now, listeners to Opening Arguments can get a free trial membership. All you have to do is text OA to 303030. So text OA to 303030. You get free access to the entire platform, all of the workouts, the nutrition information. There are cooking guides. There's support. There's online community. There are like a million people online that all participate in the online community. And you can access all of their workout materials and give it a try. So send out Text OA to 303030 and try Beachbody On Demand. So, okay. I understand that. I want to talk about kind of the interplay between how science gets into the courtroom, because I think that's really kind of the fundamental issue that we're going to get to.
Yes.
But I want to go back. I want to pick up another one of your threads.
We have so many rabbit trails. We're very tangenty people. Well, I interrupt myself sometimes even, which I think this drives my poor husband nuts. I think there are times he just looks at me and goes, I'm going to wait until she breathes. One day she will take a breath.
I was trying and I think you went 11 solid minutes without me doing that. And that's usually my territory. So, talk to me about the role of Roundup in the marketplace, right? Like you said, right after the introduction of Roundup, we've all seen the graphs, right? It soon came to a position of market dominance. How much of the market is of pesticides is of herbicides? Let's be pedantically correct. Is Roundup and what did that replace, right? Like what if Roundup goes away? What's the regime to which we're going to return? Go ahead.
That is a good question. I'm not sure what percentage of the marketplace it is actually. I'd have to double check on that. I hate giving incorrect data out. It would, and I mean, I've been seeing the chatter from farmers though. It would fundamentally change farming if it went away though. Telling you what percentage of the pesticide market would be hard because, you know, there are so many other things that we spray on crops in terms of herbicide, it is the number one herbicide on the planet by far. If you look at other herbicides that were used before it, most of them not all of them, but a ton of them just died off in use. Like there are some that, like I'm pretty sure most of them are still manufactured, and partially because there are times when once in a while the crop it's just not appropriate for, it doesn't work on, or occasionally you'll get a resistant crop and you'll need something a little stronger to kill it off for the season. And that's why we still at least manufacture some of the stronger ones. They don't get used mm-hmm. all that often. Like I'll, for example, there are insecticides that you don't whip out until there's a huge infestation. It's like last year, and this is what happens when you ban pesticides, is that people end up using stronger ones. A few years ago, I gave a talk up in Ontario to the Ontario Grain Farmers Association. And just for the record, if you ever have a chance to go speak to Canadian farmers, go. You will never get a kinder, nicer audience. I mean, they're Canadian farmers. What do you get exactly what you expect. Really nice people. But
shockingly, they don't send that many requests to US-based lawyers to come up and yeah. my level of expertise.
I'm turning them down all the time though. They're really interested in
but you guys are so nice. Why wouldn't they ask you to go up? But I vouch for you. Anyways, but yeah, they told
we'll
me
do,
this,
we'll do a live OA in Ontario.
It's,
absolutely.
I'm just saying if I'm up there, we can get up. Well, it'll be fun. Anyways, but this kind of broke my heart. And this is what we're seeing happening here is a similar thing that happened up there, is that they legislated so that and it was during the whole Beepocalypse scare. They legislated so that these farmers couldn't use neonics until they had proven that they had an infestation. Now, farmers do they spray preventatively in a lot of cases, but spraying preventatively prevents having to use much stronger, much more dangerous pesticides in the future. So what, as it was explained to me by several people there, agronomists, farmers, entomotoxicology experts, they're like, what happens is you take away the neonics, the least, the ones that don't harm the non-target species anywhere near as much. You have to prove an infestation to who knows who in the agricultural board. And by the time you prove you have an infestation, you have to use another, and they told me which pesticide it was, you have to use a much stronger pesticide, which actually does kill the bees. And I'm like, this is this is lunacy. So it's, and I mean, the people, and I asked, I'm like, were there any farmers involved in this decision? Did they have any biologists, anyone advising them through this? How was this decision made? They're like, nope, bunch of bureaucrats decided it. And that just intrinsically bugs me. And I think it should bother anyone who wants their food supply safe. Like, shouldn't you want science behind these decisions? And this is what happened here. Is, you know, the same thing. There was fear, there was an overreaction. And I think there was, you know, kind of understandably, there was, like, I get why people kind of hate Monsanto. There's been a long history of like, and I mean, I get it. I have friends who work there. The company now is very different than it used to be. But, you know, looking at the long history of things they've produced, it is hard to be okay with a company. If you aren't very acquainted with it, if you haven't looked into the history, how do you get okay with that, you know? And I get that suspicion, but I also wish that people who, you know, claim to love farmers would talk to a few of them.
Well, and let's, I think that's a really, really good segue to me, the hardest question when I look at kind of the disconnect between the science and the jury verdict. There was a single piece of evidence that I think was likely very, very influential to the jury that doesn't bear in any way on the jury's findings, right? And that is, you've probably seen this, it circulates with all the articles talking about the verdict. It is the picture of the plaintiff, Mr. Johnson, the picture of his hands, right? And so he testifies. So okay, here's the
fact. Oh, I hadn't seen the hands.
Yeah, he testified that he had two separate accidents that resulted in Roundup being dumped all over him, right? And then his hands are covered in lesions, right? I mean, it looks like superhero villain bad.
Oh,
right?
Geez. Now again, he's got the hands of Deadpool.
Right. Exactly. Like, and so the central, on one level, right, the central allegation is that it is a carcinogen. And so having skin reactions in the form of these lesions, that doesn't bear at all, right? Like, something could cause lesions and not be carcinogenic. Something could, what? Go ahead, Thomas.
Does Roundup really do that? If you spill it on yourself, it's...
No.
That's the question that I was going to ask, right? Like, so how do you make sense? Because I think from a jury perspective, right, that was probably very, very emotionally persuasive.
Yeah, if I were a juror, I can, and I didn't know anything about this chemical, and I saw this man who was dying, imminently dying. I mean, I'm not going to contest that. It's horrible that this man is dying young. I don't know what caused his lymphoma, whether it was, you know, genetically he was a time bomb, or whether there was other, you know, environmental exposure. I don't know. I don't know him. And I mean, he lives a town over. Part of me wants to, like, because I very well could have run into him at the farmer's market I go to every week. Like, this is, he literally works at a school that I've driven by regularly. And it's like, oh, this, I feel for him. Like, and that's what I don't want anyone to walk away thinking that I blame him for thinking that this could have hurt him. Like, with the popular media's depiction of Roundup, this is not a strange conclusion for someone to have come to. It is an incorrect conclusion, but it's not a strange one. And it's really pretty normal for a jury to have looked at this and gone, oh man, this poor guy. But I would have hoped that they would have asked, you know, can Roundup do this? Did Monsanto test for this to have done people? Has this ever happened to someone before? And did these lesions start occurring during the cancer? Or did they, you know, did this happen when he got sick? Like, it's, was there an order of operation? What order did this all happen in? And I would guess that it was just such an emotionally charged thing that was, you know, how it was all perceived. And it's hard to know I want the courtroom transcripts, gosh darn it. But, you know, even I feel like that's something that would be incredibly hard for them to prove when those lesions occurred. And it's also hard for, you know, for the Monsanto lawyers to have proven that it didn't happen the way that they claimed, and for them to have questioned it in a way that didn't make them sound like assholes.
Yeah, you know? Well, and so the reality, right? How this happens in these kinds of toxic tort cases is that both sides essentially put on competing expert witnesses, right? And so at the end of the day, right, if you're a juror, you're left trying to weigh between the testimony of the plaintiffs, and they had about a dozen experts who testified about the relationship between glyphosate and various cancers, right? That testified as to the health risks, that used different methodological studies, right? That got up there and said, yes, there is a relationship. And then they listened to a dozen expert witnesses being put on by Monsanto. And, you know, look, as somebody who has put on that kind of testimony and cross-examined that kind of testimony, right? Like it's not hard to get up there and take the first expert and say, okay, you know, Dr. So-and-so, you know, how much were you paid to produce this report for Monsanto that you just introduced here at trial? And, you know, and the reality is, right, what Monsanto is going to do, my clients did when I was at a big firm, is you get the very best in the field. And unsurprisingly, the very best in the field tend to charge, you know, $500, $600, $700, $1,000 an hour to serve as an expert witness. And so, you know, they've got to answer something like, I billed $286,000 to produce this report. And, you know, and the jury kind of gags and says, yeah, well, you know, great. And I have used that approach, right? I have gone in and said, you know, what were you paid to produce this? Ultimately, you know, we have this system. So what the way in which the law works is, and the states have a version of this, but most of my practice is in federal court. And so the federal rule is Rule 702 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. And like I said, most states track this, that basically says when you can admit expert testimony. And that standard is something that I think a lot of people who aren't lawyers find a little bit counterintuitive, right? So essentially the idea is that if in the judge's estimation, and the judge gets discretion here, the expert testimony will assist the trier of fact in determining any issue in the case, and the testimony is based on, and here's the language from the rule, quote, sufficient facts or data, and is the product of, quote, reliable principles and methods, then it becomes admissible. And you're laughing as a scientist because you can see, right, like plenty of things that are extreme minority positions in science nevertheless would meet that kind of bar, right? Like it doesn't require that your expert be using the most common, you know, the majority consensus, right? Even the overwhelming consensus. You can put on experts that have minority or even fringe views. And typically what courts say is, right, it's a kind of marketplace of ideas argument, right? They're like, look, we serve a gatekeeping function. We're going to keep out stuff that's total crap. But if there is a dispute, right, then put your experts on, let the other side put their experts on, and then try and impeach those experts in cross-examination and ask them about their methodology and that sort of thing. But, you know, in this case, what Monsanto tried to do was they moved to exclude and then to strike the testimony of the plaintiff's experts. And the court ruled, they said, where the validity, strengths, and weaknesses of studies are subject to scientific information and debate, the trial court may not step in and resolve the debate over the validity of the studies. So in other words, yeah, it right. So the court kind of throws up its hands and says, look, we're not going to decide this for the jury. We're going to let the jury figure it out.
They basically said that a group of 12 random assholes, and I'm sure they're very nice people, but they're not scientists. I don't know.
No, please continue to dump on my profession. No, it's all good. It's all good.
No, I mean, no. The jurors. I didn't say the lawyers. I said the jury. I'm just saying a group of 12 random people with a known amount of toxicology background who I'm sorry, but like that's just this is not how science works. Like, would you ask 12 people who have never worked as mechanics to by jury figure out what's wrong with your carburetor? No, but somehow toxicology works this way? F*** you. I didn't go to grad school for this shit. Sorry, I'm just a little mad.
Yeah, could I'm you... sure the now the listeners just heard a bunch of horns and stuff.
but sorry, this is a family
show. I think that expletive-laden rant is a good capstone on this segment. I think that works well. And thank you so much for coming on and explaining to us non-toxicology people how that all works. So it's very disappointing.
I mean, if I could just leave one tiny little thing other than that expletive-laden rant so that people don't think ill of me. It's not that juries can't do anything. There's obviously a lot of room for that in the political and judicial system. It's just that this is not how science works, and I really hope that people understand that it's not that there weren't new insights to be found about Roundup, but this is something that scientists knew far and wide was not carcinogenic, and there could have been a lot of other causes for this man's cancer. The fact that he worked with Roundup every day, that is one thing that he worked with every day. He might have drank coffee every day, which was also a known carcinogen. Yeah, coffee. We live in California. We have signs in front of there are signs at Disney World saying that they use known carcinogens there. There are signs in front of your seaweed, like in front of seaweed at the supermarket saying it's a known carcinogen. There are so many things that are on the IARC's list. And knowing that they had a report that was tampered with to turn Roundup into an arbitrary carcinogen on their list, that should give people some pause before they accept this jury's pronouncement of Roundup as causing cancer. So I'm worried for the future of agriculture based on these 12 people's decision that Roundup caused cancer. That's all.
Well said.
I think that's a great way. Yeah.
And thank you so much for the breakdown, Yvette. And hey, throw out your plugs if people want to find you. Where can they go?
For more expletive-laden rants, please come join me at imatscibabe.com, facebook.com/scibabe. And for 280-character rants, I'm at the scibabe, both on Twitter and on Instagram for pictures of my adorable little dog.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
And it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. I think we can agree. We've never said this before, but I'm making this announcement. It's tied for first best
day of the week.
Yeah, so, absolutely. It's a tie. We tallied it up and let's do it. Thank our new patrons. Go ahead, Andrew.
So thank you to Randy Payne. Thank you to Angry Kenny Grows Dash. You're welcome, Brian. Thank you to Help Me, I Worship OA. Thank you to James Reed, to Casey, Chris Waltrip, and the all-powerful Atheismo. Thank you all so much for signing up. Patreon.com/law.
Fantastic. And close Twitter and volunteer on a progressive campaign. Oh, that's a great message.
Ooh,
good job.
Good advice.
Michelle Jacobson, Justin, Master Race Cake Shop. Master Race Cake Shop. That's awesome. I'll show you a firm offer. Harold Godso and Lost Midwesterner. Thank you, new patrons. We really appreciate you coming on board. Hope you enjoy the content.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, it's TTGBE and Cybabe. Let's find out if you're also Law Babe here and see who got this one right.
All right, so this was another one of Thomas's favorite TTT and YBE questions, which is a contracts question. So this asked, you had a seller who agreed specifically to make 1,000 custom ball bearings for a buyer, delivery in 60 days. Buyer backs out 55 days in after the goods have been manufactured. The seller mitigates damages by reselling to a salvage company. And the question is, what is the appropriate measure of damages? And the choices were A, $2 per set. That is the difference between the cost of manufacture and the price the buyer agreed to pay. B, $6 per set, representing the difference between the cost of manufacture and the salvage price. C, $8 per set, that is lost profits plus unrecovered cost of manufactured, or D, nominal damages. And obviously, we didn't give this away while you two were answering, but just for our listeners, right? Nominal damages means damages in name only, right? So that is essentially nothing. And the argument on nothing was because the seller failed to resell the goods by public auction. And we have a drum roll we can insert here.
Yeah, that was good. Good, you, Brian, use that for all future drum rolls. That was good.
The saddest little drum roll ever.
I am pleased to announce that you both got the answer correct with
yes.
C, $8 per set. Here's the rationale, and actually, I would not have known. I'm gonna read you the specifics from the National Council of Bar Examiners, and I'm gonna tell you I had no idea on the specifics. So, but I would have gotten there the same way you did by remembering the general principle in contracts is that what the law seeks to do is to put the party who has had a contract breached in the position they would have been in had the breaching party not breached the contract, right? So they
that
are entitled
sense.
To the benefit of the bargain, right? And that operates as both a ceiling and a floor, right? So it operates as a floor in a case like this where all of a sudden they're scrambling. They specifically made this product. They thought they were going to get $10 a unit and they only got $2 a unit. So they're entitled to the $8 differential. It can also operate as a ceiling because there's what we call a theory of efficient breach, right? And so the classic way in which we explain that is I agree to sell you 1,000 units at $1 a piece. And then over time, all of a sudden now I have somebody else who's willing to pay me $5 a unit, but I'm selling all of my stuff to you. And what the law wants me to do is breach my contract with you, pay you the full dollar a unit, pay you the $1,000, but get the $5 a unit from somebody else, right? It wants to maximize the economic value of the transaction. And that's why, in general, breach of contract, right? Like no moral approbation attaches to it. It's just that you don't get, other than in rare circumstances, not worth talking about here, you don't get punitive damages, you don't get exemplary, right? You just put the person back in the position they would have been in if you hadn't breached the contract. This specific question was intended to test your knowledge of UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code, Section 2-708, Subsection 2, which requires that a seller is entitled to the profit the seller would have made plus an allowance for costs reasonably incurred minus payments received for the resale of the goods. You didn't need to know any of that, as none of the three of us did, in order to come up with the right answer. So,
well, I did, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, obviously, right. But
yeah.
But there you go. Congratulations to both of you. Yvette is still perfect on the show.
We're going to have me come back just so that Thomas, we can have something that I get, you know, that.
I'm not sure what your incentive for ever picking a different answer from me. We'll have to, you know what we'll have to do? We'll make you write down your answer ahead of time before you hear my answer. That's how, that'll be the fairness way.
Oh, yeah,
we will do that next.
I just got really lucky because it was that a guy had broken into a guy's house and got kicked out into a horrible snowstorm. And I thought it was
that one. Yeah.
Here's the thing. And I understand, like, I thought
we don't need to go back into old TGB questions. You got it right. You're two for two. We've got to get out of here. Thank you so much for playing. You're still ahead.
Next time, Yvette, we will make you answer a real property question. That's the real test.
Let's do a podcast that's just Yvette answers real property questions.
Oh, Jesus.
I have no clue
about tax law or property law. So I'll die on all of those. It'll just be me guessing. You'll be like, you're wrong. So that'll be fun.
That sounds awesome. Let's get this into production immediately.
All right, Yvette, thank you so much for playing along. And thanks again for joining us for that breakdown. That was really good, really informative. And we'll see you next time Food Babe strikes, I guess.
or whatever
the bat
Gwyneth
signal.
Or the
bat signal. The babe signal.
The sigh signal. It'll be good.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
So in honor of you two both getting the answer correct, we're going to go with an incorrect answer for our winner. And the funniest one comes from somebody, which is at Dear Body Talk on Twitter, who writes, the answer is clearly D, public auction, because, socialists are scary and taking over our democracy, obviously. Pretty good. Most people also got it right, but somebody got it wrong. And by daring to be wrong when everyone else was right, somebody is this week's winner at Dear Body Talk on Twitter. Everyone give somebody a follow.
All right, well, that's our episode. Thanks again to Cy Baby Vet for coming on. Very informative. Thanks to Andrew, and I'm serious. Next time she comes on, she's got to send you her answer first, because I'm never – she'll just – you know, she can always have that upper hand. No, it's okay. Either way, it was fun. I'm glad we both got it right. And, man, I'm cruising toward 60%. It's possible. Do you believe in miracles?
Very, very excited.
All right. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for patronizing us, and we'll see you on Friday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.